This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is one of the founders of the environmental movement, Barry Commoner. In 1980, Commoner ran for president on the Citizens Party ticket, a progressive party he helped found. Commoner is a biologist. It was concern about nuclear fallout from atmospheric testing in the 1950s that first got him out of the laboratory. He helped organize the first Earth Day in 1970, and he founded the Center for Natural Systems, which is now affiliated with Queens College in New York City. This research organization studies energy pollution and resource problems of big cities. Their latest project is a model recycling program in Buffalo, New York, and East Hampton, Long Island. Commoner has a new book called Making Peace with the Planet. I asked him how he thinks the environmental movement has progressed in the last 20 years.
In 1970, the country set out with very strong intentions to clean up the environment. And it's time to ask, 20 years later, what have we accomplished? And the answer is not much. Mm-hmm. Most people know that the environment is just about as bad as it was. And what I did in writing Making Peace with the Planet was to go back to the numbers. We have pretty good numbers now on the amount of various air pollutants that are emitted year by year, and the state of water pollution year by year. And what you see immediately is that most, nearly all, of the pollutants have improved only slightly and in many cases have become worse. So, for example, the air pollutants have come down maybe 18%. You look at water pollution and you find that at the test sites, about 400 of them in rivers across the country, 90%. At 90% of the sites, there's been either no improvement or they've gotten worse. In other words, by and large, we have not accomplished what we set out to do. Now, the interesting thing is that we have done a couple of things right. A handful of pollutants have really been improved. For example, lead in the air has come down 94%. That's a good piece of work. DDT and polychlorobiphenyls in our bodies are down about 80%. When you look at these results, what you see is a bimodal distribution. Most of the pollutants, nearly all, slightly improved or have gotten worse, but a handful, we really did it right. And we have to ask, what did we do right and what did we do wrong? What we did wrong was to rely on controls, the exhaust devices, the scrubbers on power plant smokestacks. That doesn't work. In the few cases where we got good results, we did a very simple thing. We prevented the production of the pollutant. We prevented its getting into the environment. For example, the reason why lead is down so much is that we've taken it out of gasoline. In other words, we changed the way in which we produce gasoline to eliminate the source of the pollutant. We took the lead out. DDT and PCB have been banned. They're not used anymore. As a result, less is going into the environment.
Are you suggesting that the environmental movement should give up on limiting certain pollutants and just work on things that they could ban altogether?
That's right. The story is that the only way to really clean up the environment is to go back to the origin of the problem. See, what we've been doing is waiting until the pollutant is out in the environment. Every one of the laws that was passed goes into effect only after a pollutant is found in the environment. Then you start hassling over what's allowable and so on. But then it's too late. Once the pollutant has been produced by agriculture, industry, power plants, it's too late.
So how does this figure into your assessment of how Congress and the Environmental Protection Agency have been dealing with environmental issues?
Well, the entire legal framework and the regulatory framework is based on controls. In fact, you see this in the new Clean Air Bill. That is called the Clean Air Control Act. And all that they've done is to say they're going to make the controls slightly more stringent. So 30% less nitrogen oxides. That isn't going to do much. Because, for example, suppose we do cut emissions down by 30%. Probably in the next 5 or 10 years, there'll be 30% more cars driving, wiping out the entire effect of the Clean Air Bill. Now, incidentally, EPA, in January of 1989, issued a pollution prevention policy statement, which acknowledged all the things I've just been saying. In other words, they know that this is the only way it's going to work.
Well, what industries would be wiped out or severely crippled if we were trying to ban all the pollutants instead of limiting the amount of pollutants released into the atmosphere?
Well, most industries would do fine. Let's take agriculture. Agriculture is now responsible for a good deal of pollution in groundwater and water supplies from pesticides and the use of nitrogen fertilizer. The pollution prevention strategy says, okay, stop using it. That means organic farming. What will happen? The farmers will make as much money as they're making now. We did a study 15 years ago that showed that, and it was confirmed just a few months ago by a report from the National Academy of Sciences. Now, who will it hurt? The petrochemical industry. And in fact, most industries produce good things. Food, electricity. Well, there we have to go solar. That means introducing photovoltaic cells. It may mean that there'll be more independent producers of electricity than central power plants, so it might hurt the utilities. The industry that'll really be hurt is the petrochemical industry, because almost everything it produces is a substitute for something else. You know, I'm 72 years old, and I well remember when I was a teenager eating food. And that food was produced with no pesticides and no nitrogen fertilizer. In other words, it can be done. What will be hurt there will be the chemical producers. The petrochemical industry really needs to be rolled back. There are a few things it makes that are absolutely essential and irreplaceable. Pharmaceutical drugs, for example, or videotape, for that matter. And there are probably some other things. But the great bulk of what the petrochemical industry produces can be replaced. And I think it'll have to be replaced. Let me show you what a bind they're in. If we required the petrochemical industry to really destroy all of the toxic chemicals that it produces, and we now know roughly how much that is, the only way to destroy it is to burn it, incinerate it. That's not a good thing to do, but it's the best you can do. It would cost about 20 times the total profit of the petrochemical industry to destroy all of its toxic waste annually. The petrochemical industry is not paying its environmental bill, and if it did, its economic position would be wiped out.
If you see the petrochemical industry as one of the villains in this story, which is the way that you're describing it...
Yes, I do.
Then what are you recommending that environmental activists confront the industry directly or go through regulatory groups or through Congress to try to put controls on the industry?
Well, you don't need my recommendations. It's already happening. The environmental movement is split in two now. The old line lobbying groups in Washington, an Environmental Defense Fund, for example, NRDC, they are locked in with EPA in debating how much pollution is acceptable. That's really what it's all about. How many people will we expect to die from exposure to a particular carcinogen? Now, the grassroots groups, and they amount to some 5,000 or 6,000 local groups, one fighting a local incinerator, another fighting a local toxic dump or a landfill. These groups, and they're organized nationally in Greenpeace, in the National Toxics Campaign, in the PIRGs, the Public Interest Research Groups on campuses, and in the Citizens Clearinghouse for Toxic Waste. They have now grouped together and have formally adopted the pollution prevention strategy.
You know, sometimes I hear environmentalists talking about the need to weatherize everybody's home and to have more solar energy, and that we'll soon be living in rural villages and growing our own food. And I've been really trying to sort out how much of this is middle-class fantasy and how much of this is really rational projection for what might happen in the near future in our country.
Well, you know, the environmental movement is a sort of a Rorschach. People read into it what they have in their heads. And there are people who would like to live in the country. And it's very easy to sort of derive from what we know about ecology, a metaphor, which says that we should be close to nature. And that means getting into the country. That really isn't what the data of environmentalists tell us. Sure, if you concentrate people in the city, it's going to be hard to do with their waste what ecology calls for, which is to get it back to the soil. But it can be done. For example, we here in New York, we're struggling with the prospect of having to stop dumping sewage sludge into the ocean. Well, the right thing to do with it is to turn it into compost and return it back to the soil. We're losing billions of tons of soil every year through erosion. There are places where there's just a few inches of soil left in the Midwest. Well, what a wonderful idea it is to return to the soil the organic matter that was represented by the food that it was made and turned into sewage. Now, mechanically, in terms of engineering, that can be done. In other words, the principles of ecology can guide us in a city.
Mm-hmm. You ran for president in 1980.
I lost.
Yes. what were some of the difficulties, forgetting all the money that you didn't have and that you weren't one of the big parties, right?
It's hard to forget.
Okay. Well, what are some of the difficulties of running a campaign on environmental issues, especially 10 years ago?
Well, it wasn't a campaign on environmental issues.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that environmentalism encompasses all of politics. It was a progressive campaign. Yes, it included the environment. It included a sharp cut. I think I called for 50% cut in the military budget. Negotiations to end all retire all nuclear weapons, new housing. It was a progressive campaign. But I'll tell you what the main difficulty was, is the difficulty that we all suffer from, and that is the trivialization of politics, especially in presidential election years, when everything turns into TV soundbites. The most important piece of information I can give you about my presidential campaign is this. In Albuquerque, I was interviewed by a TV reporter, and he said to me, "Dr. Commoner, are you a serious candidate, or are you just running on the issues?"
Right.
That tells it all. That tells it all.
Would you have actually wanted to become president? Because let's face it, if you get the job, then you're stuck with actually having to...
You have to do it.
You have to do it, and it's really hard
to
do.
Well, I really wasn't thinking about that until Reagan got elected. But when he got elected, I wished I had won.
What do you think you would have been most effective in actually changing if you
Who,
were president?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, I have some understanding of the way in which some of our major problems have originated. And I guess I have some capability in explaining these things to people. My sense of what a politician ought to be, what a political leader ought to be, is a teacher. You know, my friend Margaret Mead always used to say, the function of a leader is to recognize what's just below the surface in people's mind and bring it to the surface, express it. And that's teaching. Now, we haven't had a political teacher of that sort, as far as I'm concerned, since Franklin D. Roosevelt. And we badly need them. That's the sort of thing that I think a political leader ought to be doing. The environmental crisis cries out for leadership. For example, tomorrow, or let's say on April 22nd, Earth Day, Mr. Bush, if he wanted to really earn the self-appointed title of environmental president, could, by a stroke of the pen, start the entire transition toward clean technologies and a clean environment. For example, he could order that federal cafeterias will thereafter buy organic food. That would immediately create a market for organic food. Suppose that Mr. Bush said, from now on, the government will use only recycled paper. That would end all of the squawking about there's no market for recycling newspapers and old paper. In other words, that would be leadership. And there are things like that that can be done even without any new legislation.
Now, you're a socialist, yes?
Well, I believe in what I like to call social governance of the means of production. But I'm not sure that you need to own, I don't think the public needs to own the means of production. In other words, what we need is a way of having social interest enter into the corporate boardroom, where all the decisions are made now on the basis of a single criterion, maximizing the profit.
Did the movement against communism in Eastern Europe have any effect on your own political views, or do you see those as two separate issues?
Oh, I've been enormously encouraged by what's happened in Eastern Europe. It came about just as I was finishing Making Peace with the Planet. And one of the things I point out in Making Peace with the Planet is that despite immediate things like federal purchases, in the long run, we'll have to work out a way of having social interest impact on corporate decisions. And that's a basic ideological shift in this country. And, you know, I've said these things in speeches, and people always say, oh, but how is that going to happen? And I finally realized what the message from Eastern Europe was. The message was this, that here were people for three-quarters of a century constrained in situations where their democratic impulse couldn't be expressed. And suddenly, they found a way to express it in very simple ways. The East Germans did it by leaving the country. In Czechoslovakia, they simply came out into the streets. And what I said in the book finally was, you know, at a time like this, when we have seen these marvelous expressions of the innate impulse toward democracy, it would be unworthy and unbecoming of us to say we can't figure out a way of achieving eco-democracy, where we bring the social interest in environmental quality to bear on corporate decisions.
You spent part of the 1980s consulting on recycling, working specifically in Long Island. Why have you made recycling an issue that you're participating so actively in?
The center, the research institute that I direct, the Center for the Biology of Natural Systems, has a charter. The charter says that we are supposed to help communities solve their environmental and energy problems. The moment we moved to New York from St. Louis and settled down at Queens College, we were besieged with questions about the city's proposal to build a huge trash-burning incinerator at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And so we decided to help answer questions about it and immediately discovered that these incinerators are an environmental disaster. We do research, and we studied the chemistry of what happens in incinerators and developed the theory that dioxin, which comes out of the stack, is literally synthesized in the incinerator, so that when you turn on an incinerator, the world has more dioxin in it than it had before. Within a couple of years, a big study in Canada proved that we were right. And that indicated pretty clearly that that was the wrong way to go about dealing with the trash problem, which was a growing crisis. And we then helped the local groups explain this to their city officials, and we're proud to think of the fact that a number of incinerators have been abandoned because of public opposition of that sort. But the people knew that something had to be done about the trash, and we began to get requests. Well, what's the right way to do it? So we sat down and looked at that, and in particular, when the town of East Hampton asked us for help, we devised the system of recycling. This is clearly the only way in which we're going to prevent the trash problem. Because, you see, trash, we create trash. You know, if you empty a mayonnaise jar, while it's in your hand there, empty, it's not trash. It's a perfectly good jar. If you put it in a separate container so it goes back to the glass factory to be made into more jars, then you avoided trash. On the other hand, if you toss it in the bin with everything else, it's trash, and you've created a problem.
Barry Commoner, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Environmentalist Barry Commoner. His new book, Making Peace with the Planet, is published by Pantheon. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.